and sleep. You're safe. You're safe with me." The girl lowered her hand. She sighed. When the lines in the girl's face smoothed out somewhat, Laura repeated the question. "Do you know who I am?" Melanie made a wordless, murmuring, whimpering sound. "Do you know who I am, Melanie?" Lines of worry or fear returned to the child's face, and she said,
It.
Taking a different tack, Laura said, "What are you afraid of, Melanie?"
It. There.
Fear was in her voice now, as well as carved into the pale flesh of her face.
"What do you see?" Laura asked. "What are you afraid of, honey? What do you see?" There.
Pepper cocked her head and arched her back. The cat had become tense, watching the girl intently. The air was unnaturally still and heavy. Although it wasn't possible, the shadows in the corners of the room seemed darker and larger now than they had been a moment ago.
"It. There. No.
Laura put one hand on her daughter's creased brow, reassuring her, and waited expectantly as the girl strove to speak. A strange, disconcerting feeling came over her, and she felt a chill creeping like a living thing up the length of her spine.
"Where are you, Melanie?" "No."
"Are you in the gray room?" The girl was audibly grinding her teeth, squeezing her eyes shut, fisting her hands, as though resisting something very strong. Laura had been planning to regress her, take her back in time to the gray room in that Studio City house, but it seemed as though the girl had drifted back there without encouragement, as soon as she'd been hypnotized. But that didn't make sense. Laura had never heard of spontaneous hypnotic regression. The patient had to be guided, encouraged backward to the scene of the trauma.
"Where are you, Melanie?" No. "Easy. Be still. What are you afraid of?" "Please. No."
"Be calm, honey. What do you see? Tell me, baby. Tell Mommy what you see. The tank? The deprivation chamber? No one's going to make you go back in there, honey." But that wasn't what frightened the girl. Laura's reassurance didn't calm her.
The
aversion therapy chair, the electric chair, you'll never be put in that again, either. Something else terrified the girl. She shuddered and began to strain against Laura, as if she wanted to get away, run.
"Honey, you're safe with me," Laura said, holding her tighter than before. "It can't hurt you. Opening! It's opening! No, it... coming! Open!"
"Easy," Laura said. As the chill climbed all the way up her back and reached the nape of her neck, she sensed that something of terrible importance was about to happen. Chapter 15. Behind his back, Lieutenant Felix Porteau of the Scientific Investigation Division was called Poirot. After Agatha Christie's pompous Belgian detective, it was clear to Dan that Porteau preferred to think of himself as Sherlock Holmes. In spite of his stocky legs, pot belly, slumped shoulders, Santa Claus face, and high-domed, bald head. To bolster his desired image, Porteau was seldom without a curved-stem pipe in which he smoked an aromatic blend of shag tobacco. The pipe was not lit when Dan entered Porteau's office, but the Sid man snatched it up from an ashtray and used it to point toward a chair.
"Sit down, Daniel. Sit down. I've been expecting you, of course. I imagine you're here to inquire after my findings in the Studio City affair."
"Amazingly perceptive, Felix."
Porteau rocked back in his chair. "A singular case, this one. Naturally, it'll be several days before the full results are in from my laboratory."
It was always my laboratory with Felix. As if he wasn't in charge of a big city police department's forensics unit, but was instead conducting experiments in one room of his private quarters above Baker Street.
"However, I could, if you wish,
share some of the preliminary findings.
That would be gracious of you.
Porteau bit on the mouthpiece of the pipe, gave Dan a sly look, and smiled.
You mock me, Daniel.
Never.
Yes, you mock everyone.
You make me sound like a wise ass.
You are.
Thanks so much.
But a nice, witty, intelligent, charming wise ass, and that makes all the difference.
Now you make me sound like Cary Grant.
Isn't that how you see yourself?
Dan thought about it.
Well, maybe half Cary Grant, and right now half Wile E. Coyote.
Who?
The coyote in the Roadrunner cartoons. Ah, and how so?
I get the feeling a giant boulder just rolled off the edge of a cliff above me, and it's falling toward me right now, going to smash me flat at any second.
The rock is this case?
Yeah. Any latent prints that are going to help us?
Porteau opened a desk drawer and withdrew a pouch of tobacco. He began to prepare his pipe.
Lots of prints belonging to the three victims all over the house. Others belonging to the little girl, although those were in the converted garage.
The lab.
The gray room, as one of my men called it.
Then she was always kept in that room?
That's certainly the most logical deduction, yes. We do have a few parcels from the hall bathroom that conceivably could be hers, but none anywhere else in the house.
And nothing else? No prints at all that might have belonged to the killers?
Oh, certainly. We found numerous other prints, mostly partials. We're putting them through the new high-speed computerized comparison program, trying to match them with prints of known criminals on file, but we've had no luck so far. Not likely to have any, either.
He paused, having tamped the tobacco into the generous bowl of his pipe, and searched his pockets for a match.
In your experience, Daniel, how many times has a murderer left clear, unsmudged, and easily identifiable fingerprints at the scene of his crime?
Twice, Dan said, in 14 years. So we'll get no help from prints. What have we got?
Porteau got his pipe fired up, exhaled Swedish smoke, and shook out the match.
No weapon was found.
One of the victims had a fireplace poker.
Porteau nodded.
Mr. Cooper intended to defend himself with it, apparently, but it was never used to strike anyone. The only blood on it was Cooper's own, and only a few drops of that, all part of the natural spray pattern that spotted the walls and the floor around the body.
So Cooper didn't manage to land any blows on his assailant, and he wasn't hit with the poker himself.
Precisely.
Did the vacuum crew come up with anything besides dirt?
The results are being analyzed. Frankly, I'm not optimistic.
Porteau usually was optimistic, another Holmesian trait, so his pessimism in the current case was especially disturbing. Dan said, "What about the scrapings from under the victim's fingernails?"
"Nothing of interest. No skin, no hair, no blood, but their own under their nails, which probably means they didn't get a chance to claw at their assailants."
But the killers had to move in close. I mean, Felix, they beat these people to death.
Yes, but although they had to get close, none of them seems to have been wounded. We took scores of blood samples from every surface in those rooms, only to discover that all of it belonged to the victims.
They sat in silence. Porteau puffed clouds of fragrant smoke into the air above his head. A distant look came into his eyes as he pondered the evidence in the case, and if he, like Sherlock, had played a violin, he would have reached for it now. At last, Dan said, "I assume that you saw the photographs of the bodies?"
"Yes, horrible. Incredible. Such fury."
"Did you get the feeling that this one is going to be really weird?"
"Daniel, I find all murder to be weird," Porteau said.
"But this one seems weirder than usual."
"Weirder than usual,"
Porteau agreed and smiled, as if pleased by the challenge. "I'm beginning to get the creeps."
"Look out for that falling boulder, Mr. Coyote."
Dan left the said lieutenant in his aromatic haze, and rode the elevator back down, this time to the basement, where pathology was located. Chapter 16. Still in a hypnotic state, the girl said,
"No."
"Melanie, honey, take it easy. Take it easy now. Nobody's going to hurt you." The girl tossed her head, drawing the quick, shallow inhalations indicative of panic. A half-born wail of fear and dread was trapped in her throat, and issued only as a thin, high-pitched "yee-ee-ee." She squirmed and tried to push herself off her mother's lap. Laura held her. "Stop struggling, Melanie. Relax, be still, be calm." Suddenly, the girl struck out at an imaginary assailant, flailing with both hands. Unintentionally, she struck her mother on the breast, then on the face, two hard and painful blows. For an instant, Laura was stunned. The blow to the face was hard enough to bring involuntary tears of pain to her eyes. Melanie rolled off her mother's lap onto the floor and began to crawl away from the couch. "Melanie, stop!" In spite of the post-hypnotic suggestion that required the girl to respond to and obey Laura's commands, she ignored her mother. She crawled past the rocking chair, making pitiful animal sounds of pure, blind terror. The calico cat stood in the rocking chair, ears flattened, hissing fearfully. As Melanie scrambled past the chair, Pepper leaped over the girl, hit the floor running, and streaked out of the study. "Melanie, listen to me!" The girl disappeared beyond the desk. Her left cheek still stinging where the child had struck her, Laura also went behind the desk. Melanie had crawled into the knee-hole and was hiding there. Laura stooped down and peered in at her. The girl sat with her knees drawn up, arms locked around her legs, hunched, chin against her knees, peering out with wide eyes that, as before, saw neither Laura nor anything else in that room. "Honey?" Gasping for breath as if she had run a long way, the girl said, "Don't let it open. Keep it shut. Tight. Shut." Earl Benton stepped into the doorway. "You okay?" Laura looked at him over the top of the desk. "Yes. Just my daughter, but she'll be okay."
"You sure? You don't need me?"
"No, no, I need to be alone with her. I can handle it." Reluctantly, Earl retreated to the living room. Laura looked under the desk again. Melanie was still breathing hard, and now she was shaking violently, too. Tears were streaming down her cheeks. "Come out of there, honey." The girl didn't move. "Melanie, you will listen to me, and you will do what I tell you. Come out of there right now." Instead, the girl tried to draw farther back into the knee-hole, though she had nowhere to go. Laura had never known a patient to rebel so completely during hypnotic therapy. She studied the girl and at last decided to allow her to remain under the desk for the time being, since she seemed to feel at least marginally safer there.
"Honey, what are you hiding from?"
No answer.
"Melanie, you must tell me, what did you see that you want her to keep shut?"
"Don't let it open,"
the girl said miserably, as if responding to Laura for the first time, although her eyes still remained focused on some horror in another time and place.
"Don't let what open? Tell me, Melanie."
"Keep it closed,"
the girl cried, and she squeezed her eyes shut and bit her lips so hard that she drew a small spot of blood. Laura reached into the knee-hole and consolingly put one hand on her daughter's arm.
"Honey, what are you talking about? I'll help you keep it closed, if you'll only tell me what you're talking about."
"The door,"
the girl said.
"What door?"
"The door."
"The door to the tank?"
"It's coming open. It's coming open."
"No,"
Laura said sharply.
"Listen to me. You have to listen to me and accept what I tell you. The door isn't coming open. It's shut, tightly shut. Look at it. See? It's not even ajar, not even open a little crack."
"Not even a crack,"
the girl said, and now there was no doubt that some part of her could hear Laura and respond, even though she continued to gaze through Laura, and even though she remained for the most part in some other reality of her own making.
"Not even a crack," Laura repeated, greatly relieved to be exerting some control at last.
The girl calmed a little. She was trembling, and her face was still lined with fear, but she was not biting her lip anymore. A crimson thread of blood sewed a curved seam down her chin. Laura said,
"Now, honey, the door's closed, and it's going to stay closed, and nothing on the other side will be able to open it, because I've put a new lock on it, a heavy deadbolt lock. Do you understand?"
"Yes,"
the girl said weakly, doubtfully. "Look at the door.
There's a big, shiny new lock on it. Do you see the new lock?
Yes,
Melanie said, more confident this time. A big brass lock, enormous.
Yes.
Enormous and strong, absolutely nothing in the world could break through that lock.
Nothing,
the girl agreed. Good, very good. Now, even though the door can't be opened, I'd like to know what's on the other side of it. The girl said nothing.
Honey, remember the strong lock. You're safe now, so tell me what's on the other side of the door.
Melanie's small white hands pulled and patted the empty air under the desk as though she were attempting to draw a picture of something.
What's on the other side of the door? Laura asked again.
The hands moved ceaselessly. The girl made wordless, frustrated sounds.
Tell me, honey. The door.
Where does the door lead?
The door.
What kind of room is on the other side?
The door to...
To where?
The door to December,
Melanie said. Her fear broke under the crushing weight of many other emotions, misery, despair, grief, loneliness, frustration, all of which were audible in the wordless sounds that she made and in her uncontrollable sobbing. Then,
Mommy, Mommy,
I'm right here, baby, Laura said, startled to hear her daughter calling for her.
Mommy?
Right here. Come to me, baby. Come out from under there. Weeping, the girl did not come, but cried again.
Mommy?
She seemed to think she was alone, far from Laura's consoling embrace, though in fact they were only inches apart.
Oh, Mommy! Mommy!
Staring into the shadowy recess beneath the desk, watching her little girl weep and gibber, reaching back in there, touching the child, Laura shared some of Melanie's feelings, especially grief and frustration. But she was also filled with a powerful curiosity. The door to December?
Mama?
Here, right here. They were so close, yet they remained separated by an immense and mysterious gulf. Chapter 17. Luther Williams was a young black pathologist working for the LAPD. He dressed as though he were the ghost of Sammy Davis Jr., leisure suits and too much jewelry, but was as articulate and amusing as Thomas Sowell, the black sociologist. Luther was an admirer of Sowell, and of other sociologists and economists in the burgeoning conservative movement within the black intellectual community, and could quote from their books at length, to greater length. Several times, he had lectured Dan on pragmatic politics, and had expounded upon the virtues of free market economics as a mechanism for lifting the poor out of poverty. He was such a fine pathologist, with such a sensitive eye for the anomalous details that were important in forensic medicine, that it was almost worth tolerating his tedious political dissections in order to obtain the information he collected from his dissections of the flesh. Almost. Luther was sitting at a microscope examining a tissue sample when Dan entered the green-tiled lab. He looked up and grinned when he saw who was visiting him.
"Danny boy, did you use those tickets I gave you?"
For a moment, Dan didn't know what the pathologist was talking about. But then he remembered Luther had bought two tickets to a debate between G. Gordon Liddy and Timothy Leary. And then something had come up to prevent him from going. He had run into Dan in the hall a week ago and had insisted that Dan take the tickets.
"It'll raise your consciousness," he said.
Now Dan fidgeted. "Well, I told you last week that I probably couldn't make it. I asked you to give the tickets to someone else."
"You didn't go?"
Luther asked, disappointed. "No time."
"Danny, Danny, you've got to make time for these things. There's a battle raging that'll shape our lives, a battle between those who love freedom and those who don't, a quiet war between freedom-loving libertarians and freedom-hating fascists and leftists."
Dan hadn't voted, or even registered to vote, in 12 years. He didn't much care which party or ideological faction was in power. It wasn't that he thought Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, were all screw-ups. They probably were, but he didn't really care. And that wasn't the reason for his stubborn political indifference. He figured society would muddle through regardless of who was in charge, and he had no time to listen to boring political arguments.
His main interest, his consuming interest, was murder, which was why he had no time for politics. Murder and murderers. Some people were capable of the most unthinkable brutality, and he was fascinated with them, not those killers who were obviously lunatics, not those who killed in mindless fits of rage or passion after being subjected to understandable provocation, but the others. Some husbands could kill their wives without remorse merely because they'd grown tired of them. Some mothers could kill their children just because they no longer wanted the responsibility of raising them, and they were without grief or even a sense of guilt. Hell, some people out there could kill anybody at all for any reason, even for trivial reasons like being cut off in traffic. They were amoral sociopaths, and Dan was never bored with them or with their aberrant psychology. He wanted to understand them. Were they mentally ill or throwbacks? Were only certain people capable of cold-blooded murder when there was no element of self-defense involved? Or were these killers a special breed? If they were special, wolves in a society of sheep, he wanted to know what made them different. What was missing in them? Why were compassion and empathy unknown to them? He didn't entirely understand his intellectual fascination with murder. He didn't have a particularly ruminative or philosophical bent, or at least he didn't think of himself in those terms. Perhaps working day after day in a world of violence and blood and death, it was impossible not to grow philosophical with the passage of years. Maybe most other homicide cops spent a lot of time contemplating the dark side of human potential. Maybe he wasn't the only one. He had no way of knowing. It wasn't the kind of thing most cops talked about. In his case, of course, perhaps his need to understand murder and the murderer's mind was related to the fact that both his brother and sister had been murdered. Maybe. Now, smelling strongly of alcohol and vaguely of other chemicals used in the pathology lab, smiling up at Dan, Luther Williams said, "Listen, Danny, next week there's a really terrific debate between..." Dan interrupted him. "Luther, I'm sorry, but I don't have time to chat. I need some information, and I need it right away." "What's the big hurry?" "I gotta pee." "Look, Danny, I know politics bores you." "No, really, it isn't that," Dan said with a straight face. "I actually gotta pee." Luther sighed. "Someday the totalitarians will take over, and they'll pass laws so you can't pee unless you have permission from the official federal urinary gatekeeper." "Ouch." "Then you'll come to me with your bladder bursting and you'll say, 'Luther, my God, why didn't you warn me about these people?'" "No, no, I promise to crawl away somewhere all by myself and let my bladder burst in silence. I promise, swear, not to bother you." "Yeah, because you'd rather let your bladder burst than have to hear me say I told you so." Luther was sitting at the lab table on a wheeled stool. Dan pulled up another stool and sat down in front of him. "Okay, hit me with the dazzling scientific insights, Dr. Williams. You have three special customers from last night, McCaffrey, Hoffritz, and Cooper."
"They're scheduled for autopsy this evening."
"They haven't been done already?"
"We have a backlog here, Danny. They kill them faster than we can cut them open."
"Sounds like a violation of free market principles," Dan said.
"Huh?
You've got a lot more supply than you have demand."
"Isn't that the truth? Would you like to go into the cooler, see the tables where we have all the stiffs stacked on top of one another?"
"No, thanks. But it sounds like a charming excursion."
"Pretty soon we'll have to start piling them in the closets with bags of ice."
"You at least seen the three I'm interested in?"
"Oh, yeah."
"Can you tell me anything about them?"
"They're dead."
"As soon as the totalitarians take over, they're going to do away with all smart-ass black pathologists first thing."
"Hey, that's what I'm telling you," Luther said.
"You've examined the wounds on those three?" His dark face darkening even further, the pathologist said,
"Never seen anything like it. Each corpse is a mass of overlapping contusions, scores of them, maybe hundreds. Such a mess, Jesus. Yet no two of those blows have the same configuration. Dozens of points of fracture, too, but there's no pattern to the bone injuries. The autopsy will tell us for sure, but based on just a preliminary examination, I'd say the bones sometimes look snapped, sometimes splintered, sometimes crushed."
Now, there's no damn way a blunt instrument used as a club can pulverize bone. A blow will crack or splinter bone, but that's strictly impact. Impact doesn't crush. Unless it's tremendous impact like you get when a car rams a pedestrian and pins him against a brick wall. Generally, you can only crush bone by applying pressure, by squeezing. And I'm talking a lot of pressure.
So, what were they hit with?
You don't get me. See, when somebody's bashed as hard and as many times as these guys were, you'll find a pattern of the striking force. Rough, smooth, sharp, rounded, whatever. And you'll be able to say, this fellow was wasted with a hammer that had a round striking surface, 1 inch in diameter, with a gently beveled edge. Or maybe it's a crowbar, the dull end of a hatchet, a bookend, or a salami. But once you've examined the wounds, you'll usually be able to put a name to the instrument. But not this time. Every contusion has a different shape. Every injury appears to have been made by a different instrument.
Pulling on his left earlobe, Dan said, I suppose we can rule out the possibility that the killer walked into that house with a suitcase full of blunt instruments, just because he likes variety. I don't see the victim standing still while he traded the hammer for a shovel and the shovel for a lug wrench.
I think that was a safe assumption. The thing is, I didn't notice one wound that looked exactly like a hammer blow or like the mark from a crowbar or a lug wrench. Each contusion was not only different from other contusions, but each was unique, oddly shaped.
Any ideas at all?
Well, if this were an old Fu Manchu novel, I'd say we have a villain who's invented a fiendish new weapon. A compressed air machine that has more force than Arnold Schwarzenegger wielding a sledgehammer.
Colorful theory, but not too damn likely.
You ever read Sox Rohmer? Those old Fu Manchu books? Hell, they were full of exotic weapons, far out methods of murder.
This is real life.
That's what they say.
Real life isn't a Fu Manchu novel.
Luther shrugged.
I'm not so sure. You been watching the news lately?
I need something better than that, Luther. I need a whole lot of help with this one. They stared at each other. Then, without a trace of humor this time, Luther said,
But that is what it looks like, Danny. Like they were beaten to death with a hammer of air.
Chapter 18 After Laura encouraged Melanie to come out from beneath the desk, she brought the girl up from the hypnotic state. Well, not up exactly. The child didn't rise to full consciousness. Rather, she moved out of the hypnotic trance and more or less sideways, returning to the semi-catatonic state in which she'd been since the police had found her. Laura had nurtured a small hope that termination of the hypnotic trance would snap the girl out of her catatonia as well. Briefly, the child's eyes did fix on Laura's, and she put one hand against Laura's cheek as if disbelieving her mother's presence.
"Stay with me, baby. Don't slip away. Stay with me."
But the girl slipped away nevertheless. The moment of contact was poignant, but brief, achingly brief. The therapy session had taken its toll from Melanie. Her face was slack with exhaustion, and her eyes were bloodshot. Laura put Melanie to bed for a nap, and the girl was asleep as soon as her head touched the pillow. When Laura went out to the living room, she discovered that Earl Benton had left his chair and had taken off his suit jacket. He had also drawn the revolver from his shoulder holster and was holding it in his right hand, down at his side, not as if he would use it that very minute, but as if he thought he might have a need for it soon. He was standing at a French window, staring outside, a worried look on his broad face.
"Earl?" she said uncertainly.
He glanced at her. "Where's Melanie?"
"Napping."
He returned his attention to the street in front of the house. "Better go sit with her." Her breath caught in her throat. She swallowed hard.
"What's wrong?"
"Maybe nothing. Half an hour ago, a telephone company van pulled up across the street, parked there. Nobody got out."
She stepped beside him at the window. A gray and blue van with white and blue lettering was across from the house, slightly uphill, parked half in sunlight and half in the shade of a jacaranda. It looked like all the other phone company vans she had ever seen. Nothing special about it.
Nothing sinister. "Why does it look suspicious to you?" she asked. "Like I said, so far as I could see, nobody got out. Maybe the repairman's just taking a nap on company time." "Not likely. Phone company's too well managed to let that sort of thing go on a lot. Besides, it just smells. I get a feeling about it. I've seen this sort of thing before, and what it means to me is that we're under surveillance."
"Surveillance? Who?"
"Hard to say, but phone company vans, well, the feds often work that way."
"Federal agents?"
"Yeah."
Astonished, she shifted her attention from the van to Earl's profile. He didn't seem to share her surprise.
"You mean, like the FBI?"
"Maybe. Or the Treasury Department, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Maybe even a security arm of the Defense Department. They're all different kinds of feds."
"But why would federal agents have us under surveillance? We're the victims. The potential victims, anyway. Not criminals."
"I didn't say it was for sure the feds. I just said they often work this way."
Staring at Earl while he stared at the van, Laura realized that he had changed. He was no longer the aw-shucks guy with the veneer of West L.A. polish. He looked harder, older than his 26 years, and his manner was more brisk and professional than before. Confused, Laura said,
"Well, if it's government men, we don't have anything to worry about."
"Don't we?
They aren't the ones trying to kill Melanie."
"Aren't they?"
Startled, she said,
"Well, of course they aren't. It wasn't the government that killed my husband and the other two."
"How do you know that?" he asked, his eyes still riveted on the telephone company van.
"Oh, for heaven's sake.
Your husband and one of the men killed with him, they used to work at UCLA."
"So?"
"They received grants for research."
"Yes, of course, but
some of those grants, maybe even most of them, came from the government, didn't they?"
Laura didn't bother to reply because Earl obviously knew the answer already.
"Defense Department grants," he said.
She nodded.
"And others?"
He said, "The Defense Department would be interested in behavior modification, mind control. The best way to deal with an enemy is to control his mind, make him your friend, without him ever realizing that he's been manipulated. A real breakthrough in that field could put an end to wars, we know it. But hell, as far as that goes, pretty much any damn government agency would be interested in mind control."
"How do you know all this about Dellen's work? I didn't tell you all this."
Instead of answering her, Earl said, "Maybe your husband and Hoffertz were still working for the government."
"Hoffertz was a discredited, but if his research was important, if it was producing results, they wouldn't care if he was discredited in the academic community. They'd still use him."
He glanced at her again, and there was a cynicism in his eyes, a weary-of-the-world expression on his face that made him appear utterly different from the way he'd looked earlier. She could no longer see the farm boy at all, and she wondered if that image of a simple man seeking polish and sophistication from a new life in L.A. had been an act. She was suddenly sure that Earl Benton, even as young as he was, had never been simple. And she was no longer sure that she should trust him. The situation had abruptly become so complex, the possibilities so multifarious, that she felt a bit dizzy. A government conspiracy? But then why would they have killed Dillon and Hoffertz if Dillon was working for them?
Earl didn't even hesitate.
"Maybe they didn't do the killing. In fact, it's highly unlikely. But maybe your husband's research was leading toward a major breakthrough with military applications, and maybe because of that, the other side had him wasted."
"Other side?"
He was watching the street once more. "Foreign agents. The Soviet Union went kaput, maybe you heard. It was in all the newspapers. The Russians are still there, and we're a long way from being best buddies with them. Then there's China, Iran, and Iraq, and Libya. There's never a shortage of enemies in the world. Power-mad men are always with us."
"This is crazy," she protested.
"Why?"
"Secret agents, spy stuff, international intrigue. Ordinary people don't get mixed up in that stuff except in the movies."
"That's just it. Your husband wasn't ordinary people," Earl said. "Neither was Hoffertz."
She couldn't look away from this man who was undergoing such a profound metamorphosis, aging, hardening before her eyes. She repeated the question that he had not answered before. "All this speculation, you couldn't have thought about any of it unless you knew my husband's field, his personality, the kind of work he might be doing. How do you know all of this about Dylan? I didn't tell you any of it."
"Dan Haldane told me."
"The detective? When?"
"When he called me just before noon."
"But I didn't even hire your firm until after 1 o'clock.
"Dan said he'd give you our card, make sure you called us. He wanted us to understand all the possible ramifications of the case right from the start."
"But he never told me there might be FBI agents and, for God's sake, Russians involved."
"He doesn't know they're involved, Dr. McCaffrey. He just realized there was the possibility that these murders had more than local significance. He didn't go into it much with you because he didn't want to worry you unnecessarily."
"Christ." The mad, seductive murmur of paranoia swelled in her mind again. She felt trapped in an elaborate web of conspiracies.
"Better go look after Melanie," Earl said. Outside, a Chevy sedan drove slowly along the street.
The car stopped beside the phone company van, then pulled forward and parked in front of it. Two men got out.
"Ours," Earl said.
"Paladin agents?"
"Yeah, I called the office a while ago after I decided the van was a surveillance operation. Asked them to send some guys to check it out, 'cause I didn't want to go over there myself and leave you two alone."
The two men who got out of the Chevy went to opposite sides of the van.
"Better go see about Melanie," Earl repeated.
"She's okay."
"Then at least step back from the window."
"Why?"
"Because I'm paid to take risks and you aren't. And I warned you at the start you'd have to do what I told you to do."
She retreated from the window, but she didn't move completely away from it. She wanted to see what was happening at the phone company van. One of the Paladin agents was still at the driver's door. The other man had gone around to the rear of the van. "If they're federal agents, there won't be any shooting," she said. "Not even if they want Melanie."
"That's right," Earl agreed. "We'd have to give her up."
"No," she said, alarmed.
"Yes, I'm afraid we wouldn't have a choice. You're the law, but then at least we'd know who had her, and we could fight to get her back through the courts. But like I said, these guys might not be feds."
"And if they're someone else?" she asked, unable to bring herself to say Russians.
"They might get nasty."
His large, strong hand curled tightly around the revolver. Laura looked past him out the window, which was streaked and spotted from the previous night's rain. The late afternoon sunlight painted the street in shades of brass and copper. Squinting, she saw one of the rear doors swing open on the phone company van. Chapter 19. Dan left the pathology department, but took only a few steps along the hall before a thought stopped him. He went back, opened the door, and leaned into the office as Luther looked up from the microscope again.
"Thought you had to pee," the pathologist said. "You've only been gone 10 seconds.
"Peed right here in the hall," Dan said.
"Typical homicide detective."
"Listen, Luther, you're a libertarian."
"Well, yeah, but there's all kinds of libertarians. You've got your libertarian conservatives, your libertarian anarchists, and your basic orthodox libertarians. You've got libertarians who believe that we should..."
"Luther, look at me, and you'll see the definition of boredom."
"Then why'd you ask?"
"I just wanted to know if you'd ever heard of a libertarian group called Freedom Now."
"Not that I remember."
"It's a political action committee."
"Means nothing to me."
"You're pretty active in libertarian circles, aren't you? You would have heard of Freedom Now if they were really a bunch of movers and shakers, wouldn't you?"
"Probably."
"Ernest Andrew Cooper."
"One of the three stiffs from Studio City," Luther said.
"Yeah, ever hear of him before this?"
"No."
"You sure?"
"Yeah."
"He's supposed to be a big wheel in libertarian circles."
"Where?"
"Here in L.A.
"Well, he's not. Never heard of him before this."
"You sure?"
"Of course I'm sure. Why are you acting like a homicide dick with me?"
"I am a homicide dick."
"You're a dick, that's for sure," Luther said, grinning. All the people you work with say so. Some of them use different words, but they all mean dick.
Dick, dick, dick. Are you fixated on that word or something?
What's wrong with you, Luther?
Are you lonely? Maybe need a new boyfriend?
The pathologist laughed. He had a hearty laugh and a smile that made you want to smile back at him.
Dan couldn't figure why such a good-natured, vital, optimistic, energetic man as Luther Williams had chosen to spend his working life with corpses.
Dr. Ermatrude Gelkenschettel, chairperson of the Department of Psychology at UCLA, had a corner office with lots of windows and a view of the campus. Now, at 4:45 in the afternoon, the short winter day was already fading, casting a muddy orange light like that of a fire settling into embers. Outside, the shadows were growing longer by the minute, and students were hurrying in deference to the evening chill which was creeping in ahead of the darkness. Dan sat in a Danish modern chair while Dr. Gelkenschettel went around the desk to a spring-backed chair behind it. She was a short, stocky woman in her 50s. Her iron-gray hair was chopped without any sense of style, and although she had never been beautiful, her face was appealing and kind. She wore blue slacks and a man's white shirt with pocket flaps and epaulets. The sleeves were rolled up, and she even wore a man's watch, a plain but dependable Timex on an expansion band. She radiated competence, efficiency, and intelligence. Though Dan had just met her, he felt that he knew her well, for his own Aunt Kay, his adoptive mother's sister, a career military officer in the WACS, was just like this woman. Dr. Gelkenschettel obviously chose her clothes for comfort, durability, and value. She didn't scorn those who were concerned about being in fashion. It had simply never occurred to her that fashion might be a consideration when it was time to replenish her wardrobe. Just like Aunt Kay. He even knew why she wore a man's watch. Aunt Kay had one, too. Because the face was larger than that on a woman's watch, and the numerals were easier to read. At first he'd been taken aback by her. She hadn't been his idea of the head of a major university's psychology department. But then he had noticed that on one full shelf of the bookcase behind her desk were more than 20 volumes that bore her name on their spines.
Dr. Gelkenschettel. She held up a hand, interrupting him.
The name's impossible. The only people who call me Dr. Gelkenschettel are students. Those colleagues whom I loathe, my auto mechanic, because you've got to keep those guys at a distance or they'll charge you a year's salary for a tune-up, and strangers. We're strangers, or the next thing to it, but we're also professionals, so let's drop the formalities. Call me Marge.
Is that your middle name?
Unfortunately, no, but Ermatrude's as bad as Gelkenschettel, and my middle name's Heidi. Do I look like a Heidi to you?
He smiled. I guess not.
You're damn right I don't. My parents were sweet, and they loved me, but they had a blind spot about names.
My name's Dan.
Much better. Simple, sensible. Anyone can say Dan. Now, you wanted to talk about Dylan McCaffrey and Willie Huffritz. It's hard to believe they're dead.
Wouldn't be so hard if you'd seen the bodies. Tell me about Dylan first. What did you think of him?
I wasn't head of the department when Dylan McCaffrey was here. I only moved into the top job a little more than 4 years ago.
But you were teaching here then, doing your own research. You were on the faculty with him.
Yes, I didn't know him well, but I knew him well enough to know I didn't want to know him any better.
I understand he was very dedicated to his work. His wife, she's a psychiatrist, called him a severe obsessive-compulsive.
He was a nut, Marge said.
The two new Paladin agents walked away from the suspicious telephone company van and came directly to Laura's front door. Earl Benton let them in. One was tall, the other short. The tall one was thin and gray-faced. The short man was slightly pudgy, with freckles across the bridge of his nose and on both cheeks. They didn't want to sit down or have coffee. Earl called the short one Flash, and Laura didn't know if that was his surname or a nickname. Flash did all the talking, while the tall one stood beside him, his long face expressionless.
"They're steamed that we blew their cover," Flash said.
"If they don't want to be made, they should be more subtle," Earl said.
"That's what I told them," Flash said.
"Who are they?"
"They showed us FBI credentials."
"You wrote their names down?"
"Names and ID numbers."
"Did the ID look real?"
"Yeah,
Flash said. What about the men? They seem like bureau types to you?
Yeah, Flash said. Sharply dressed, very cool, soft-spoken, polite even when they were angry. But that underlying arrogance, you know how they are.
I know, Earl said.
Flash said, we're heading back to the office. Check this out. See if the Bureau employs agents with those names.
You'll find the names, even if these guys aren't legit, Earl said.
What you've got to do is get photos of the real agents and see if they look like these guys.
That's what we figure to do, Flash said.
Get back to me as soon as you can, Earl said, and the other two turned toward the door. Laura said, wait.
Everyone looked at her. She said, what did they tell you? What reason did they give for watching my house?
Bureau doesn't talk about its operations unless it wants to, Earl told Laura.
And these guys didn't want to, Flash said. They'd no sooner tell us their reasons for watching you than they'd kiss us and ask us to dance.
The tall man nodded agreement. Laura said, if they were here to protect Melanie and me, they'd tell us, wouldn't they? So that means they must be here to snatch her back.
Not necessarily, Flash said.
Earl put his revolver back in his shoulder holster. Laura, see, the situation may be just as unclear and confusing to the Bureau as it is to us. For instance, suppose your husband was working on an important Pentagon project when he disappeared with Melanie. Suppose the FBI has been looking for him ever since. Now he turns up dead in peculiar circumstances. Maybe it hasn't been our government funding him these last 6 years. In which case they're bound to wonder where he's been getting his money.
Again, Laura felt as if the floor were tilting under her, as if the real world that she'd always taken for granted were an illusion. It almost seemed as though true reality might be the paranoid's nightmare world of unseen enemies and complex conspiracies. She said,
then you're telling me they're out in that telephone company van watching my house because they think someone else may come for Melanie and they want to nab them in the act. But I still don't understand why they didn't come to me and tell me they were going to be watching.
They don't trust you, Flash said.
They were angry with us for revealing their presence, not just to anyone who might have been watching out there, Earl said, but to you as well.
Puzzled, she said, why?
Earl looked uncomfortable.
Because, as far as they know, maybe you've always been in this thing with your husband.
He stole Melanie from me.
Earl cleared his throat and looked unhappy at having to explain this to her.
From the Bureau's point of view, could be that you let your husband take your daughter so he'd be able to experiment on her with no notice or interference from family or friends.
Shocked, Laura said, that's insane. You see what's been done to Melanie. How could I be party to that?
People do strange things.
I love her. She's my little girl. Dylan was disturbed, maybe crazy, okay? So he was too unbalanced to see or even care how he was hurting her, destroying her. But I'm not unbalanced, too. I'm not like Dylan.
I know, Earl said soothingly. I know you're not. She saw belief in Earl Benton's eyes, trust and compassion. But when she looked at the other two men, she saw an element of doubt and suspicion. They were working for her, but they didn't entirely believe that she had told them the truth.
Madness.
She was caught in a whirlpool that was carrying her down into a nightmare world of suspicion, deception, and violence, into an alien landscape where nothing was what it appeared to be.
Surprised, Dan said, "Not. I didn't know psychologists used words like that."
Marge smiled ruefully.
"Oh, not in the classroom and not in published papers. And certainly not in a courtroom if we're ever asked for testimony in a sanity hearing. But this is in the privacy of my office just between almost strangers, and I tell you, Dan, he was a nut. Not certifiable, mind you, not close, but not merely eccentric either. His primary area of research was supposed to be the development and application of behavior modification techniques that would reform the criminal personality. But he was always off on a tangent, riding one odd hobby horse or another. He regularly announced a deep commitment,
obsessed is the right word, to some new line of research, but after 6 months or so, he would completely lose interest in it. What were some of those hobby horses? She leaned back in her chair and folded her arms across her breasts. For a while, he was determined to find a drug therapy that would combat nicotine addiction. Does that sound sensible to you? Help smokers get off cigarettes by getting them out of drugs?
Hell's bells.
Then, for a while, he claimed to be convinced that subliminal suggestion, subconscious programming, could enable us to set aside our prejudices against a belief in the supernatural and help us open our minds to psychic experiences, so we'd be able to see spirits as easily as we see one another.
Spirits? Are you talking about ghosts?
I am, or rather, he was.
I wouldn't think psychologists would believe in ghosts.
You're looking at one who doesn't. McCaffrey was one who did.
I'm remembering the books we found in his house. Some of them were about the occult.
Probably half his hobby horses dealt with that, she said. One occult phenomenon or another.
Who would pay for this kind of research?
I'd have to look at the files. I imagine the occult stuff was done on his own, without funds, or by cleverly misusing funds meant for other work.
It's possible to misuse funds that blatantly? Isn't there some accounting required?
The government's relatively easy to dupe if you're dishonest. Sometimes thieves make the easiest target for another thief because they never see themselves as being the victims, only perpetrators.
Who financed his primary research?
He got some of his money from trust funds set up by alumni for research purposes, and corporate grants, of course, and, as I said, the government.
Mostly the government?
I'd say mostly.
He frowned. Well, if Dylan McCaffrey was a nut, why would the government want to deal with him?
Oh, well, he was a nut, and his interest in the occult was as peculiar as it was exasperating, but he was brilliant, I'll give him that. With a more stable personality, his intellect would have taken him all the way. He'd have been famous in his field, and maybe even to the general public.
Did he get Pentagon funding?
Yes.
What would he have been working on for the Pentagon?
Can't say. For one thing, I don't know. I could check the files, but even if I knew, I couldn't say. You don't have security clearance.
Fair enough. What can you tell me about Wilhelm Hofritz?
He was slime.
Dan laughed.
Dr. Marge, you certainly don't mince words.
It's only the truth. Hofritz was an elitist son of a bitch. He wanted in the worst way to be chairman of this department. Never had a chance. Everyone knew what he'd be like if he had power over us. Vicious. Abusive. He'd have run the entire department right into the ground.
He was doing defense research, too?
Almost exclusively. Can't tell you about that, either. Rumor has it that he was forced out of the university. That was a banner day for UCLA.
Why was he gotten rid of?
There was this young girl, a student. Ah, much worse than you think, Marge said. It wasn't just moral turpitude. He wasn't the first professor to sleep with a student. Half the men on the faculty would be dismissed, and maybe as much as a fifth of the women, if that rule was well enforced. He was having sex with her, yes, but he also beat her up and put her in the hospital. Their relationship was... kinky is a kind word for it. One night it got out of hand.
Are you talking about bondage games or something?
Dan asked. Yes. Hofritz was a sadist.
And the girl cooperated? She was a masochist?
Yes, but she got more than she bargained for. One night Hofritz lost control, broke her nose, 3 fingers, her left arm. I went to the hospital, saw her. Both eyes blackened, split lip, badly bruised.
Laura and Earl stood at the window, watching Flash and the tall man move down the walk in the deepening twilight. The telephone company van was only a lumpish shape, all details obscured as the oncoming night knitted together with the shadows under the curbside jacarandas. She said, "FBI, huh? They won't go away?"
"No,"
even though I'm aware of them now?
Well, they're not convinced you were conspiring with your husband. In fact, that would be one of the less likely possibilities in their eyes. They still figure someone, whoever was financing Dylan's research, will come after Melanie, and they want to be here when it happens.
But I still need you, she said, in case the FBI itself takes my daughter.
Yes. If that's what comes down, you'll need a witness in order to go after them in the courts.
She went to the couch and sat on the edge, shoulders hunched, head bowed, arms propped on her thighs.
I feel as if I'm losing my mind. Everything'll work out if...
He was interrupted by Melanie's scream.
Dan winced at Marge's description of the battered student.
But Huffert has no arrest record.
The girl wouldn't press charges.
He did that to her, and she let him get away with it?
Why?
Marge got up, went to the window, and stared down at the campus. The orange light of sunset had given way to the grays and blues of twilight. A few clouds had sailed in from the sea. At last, the psychologist said, "When we put Willie Huffert's on suspension and started looking into his previous relationships with students, we found this girl wasn't the first. There were at least four others over the years, four that we know of, all undergraduates, sexually involved with Huffert's, all playing masochist to his sadist, although none of them had been seriously injured. Until this girl, it was always more of a nasty game than anything. Those first four were willing to talk about it when we insisted, and because of our interviews with them, we uncovered some interesting, appalling, and frightening information." Dan didn't press her to continue. He suspected that it was painful and humiliating for her to admit that a colleague, even one she didn't like, was capable of these things, and that the academic community was no more noble than the human race at large. But she was a realist who could face up to unpleasant truths, a rare creature both in and out of academia, and she would tell him everything. She just needed to do it at her own pace. Still facing the twilight, she said, "None of those first four girls was promiscuous, Dan. Good kids from good families, here to obtain an education, not to escape parental authority and get some kicks. In fact, two of the four were virgins before they fell under Huffert's spell. And none was ever involved in sadomasochistic relationships before Huffert's, and certainly not after. They were repulsed by the memories of what they had let him do to them." She fell silent again. He decided that she wanted him to ask a question now, and he said, "Well, if they didn't like it, why did they do it?" "The answer to that is a bit complex."
"I can handle it. I'm a bit complex myself."
She turned from the window and smiled, but only briefly. What she had to tell him obviated amusement. "We discovered that each of those four girls had been voluntarily involved in undisclosed behavior modification experiments with Huffert's. Those experiments included post-hypnotic suggestion and a variety of ego-suppressing drugs."
"Why would they want to get involved with something like that?"
"To please a professor, to get a good grade, or maybe because it actually interested them. Students are sometimes interested in the things they study, even these days, even the low-caliber students we've been getting lately. And Huffert's did have a certain charm which was more effective with some people than others."
"Not with you."
"When he turned on the charm, I found him even more slimy than usual. Anyway, he was teaching these girls, and he charmed them. And you mustn't forget that he was well-published and well-known in his field. He had earned a certain respect."
"And it was after these experiments started that each girl found herself sexually involved with him."
"Yes."
"So you think he used hypnosis, drugs, subconscious programming to, well, to convert them?"
"To program their psychological matrices to include promiscuity and masochism. Yes. That's exactly what I think."
Melanie's shrill scream filled the house. Shouting her daughter's name, Laura hurried behind Earl Benton down the hall. Revolver in hand, the bodyguard entered the child's room ahead of Laura and snapped on the light. Melanie was alone.
The menace that had elicited her screams was one that only she could see. Dressed in white socks and the pair of white cotton underpants that she had been wearing during her nap, the child was crouched in a corner, hands held in front of her to ward off an invisible enemy,